Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is a special podcast bonus with a mindfulness and a developing the mind of the Bodhisattva meditation.
Mindfulness. Now let's meditate together the meditation of mindfulness. After we meditate for a little while, I will give a little bit of a discussion of mindfulness, and then we'll meditate again a second time. First, sit in the proper posture for meditation. If you can, cross-legged on a comfortable cushion, with your bottom a little higher than your ankles or knees, so that not much higher, like 6 inches, but like 2 or 3 inches higher if you have a second cushion to put on top of the first cushion. Cross your legs, either half lotus or full lotus if you're capable, but not if it's a strain. Sit up straight, with your shoulders relaxed but down, your hands folded one on top of the other in your lap, with your thumb tips lightly touching. Your chin a little bit tucked, and as if there were a little bit of a string on the very crown of your head, tippy-tip crown, pulling you upward. And your eyes half closed, and what the little bit of visual field left in the bottom part of your field of vision, limited to a spot somewhat in front of your nose. Not quite the strain of crossing your eyes, but almost close to that. That's ideal. Closing the eyes is not ideal, and wide open is not ideal. The reason for the half close is important in ancient writings, is that you create that way a very boring visual field, and you also don't go off into sleep or fantasy like when your eyes are closed. And instead you have a half visual field and a half eyelid sort of thing. So you kind of, the idea is you gradually, when you get used to doing that, you withdraw your attention from your visual field where we so often keep our attention when we're awake, and put your attention inside you. So now you begin by breathing, then you turn your attention to your breathing. And it's a little difficult when you pay attention to your breathing not to either breathe more quickly or take big deep breaths. And try not to do either of those, but breathe normally and yet observe your breath without interfering with it if possible. And then you count your breaths at the out-breath when you feel the air going out of the nostrils. You keep your lips are closed and teeth touching or close to closed, and tongue on the palate behind the upper teeth, but all in a relaxed way, not rigid or tense, and if possible, breathing evenly through the nostrils. So now you count these breaths. 1, 2, 3, 4, like that. And when your mind races off in some direction, you have an inner thought like, what am I doing? Why am I doing this? Am I sitting properly? what's the purpose of this, whatever it might be, or what happened yesterday, or what I am worried about tomorrow, or what do I look forward to tomorrow. If your mind goes anywhere in the past or future, or thinking about even what you're doing now, other than just counting your breath, then notice that it has happened. And then try to withdraw from doing that. As it were, you dismount the thought train that's taking you away from just simply counting. Okay? So just do that for a couple minutes. One. Two. Three. Four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, ten, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, 40, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, 51, 52, 53, 54, 55, 56, 57, 58, 59, 60. Okay, ding, ding, ding. You can come back out. Now, you may not have kept up with me up to 60. And actually, I forgot to mention, but one way of doing it, when you reach 10, you go back to 1. And that's because, especially if you're a little bit of a beginner, maybe at 2 or 3, your mind will take you away from the count. And you'll start thinking about something. And at that point, you bring the mind back, dismounting from that distracting thought, and then start again at 1. Actually, I didn't have any distraction because I've done it enough. And even though I'm making a podcast for you, I don't think about instructions or what I'm going to do next. I manage not to do that because I often teach people this in person. And of course, when you're teaching, you always are thinking what next to say. I mean, your mind is ranging along as you go along. So I can ignore it. It doesn't take me away from what I'm doing. But if you're a beginner, I'm sure you had a lot of thoughts and questioning thoughts about why you're doing it, as well as reveries of the past and future. So let's talk a little bit about what this mindfulness is and what it's supposed to do. Now, in the Buddhist tradition, the way in which you achieve nirvana, freedom from suffering, is by recognizing that it is your true reality, actually. It isn't by doing some magical, crazy thing where you go somewhere else into some other thing. Although in a way, when you recognize that your true reality and the reality of the world is nirvana and freedom of suffering, and that all the suffering that we undergo comes from our failure to understand the reality of our existence and the reality of the things around us that we interact with, things and persons around us that we interact with. And the minute we understand that reality, that doesn't make them all go away. But it means that we see sort of simultaneously with their reality that they do not disturb the overriding or undergirding or permeating reality of nirvana, the blowing away of suffering. But the method, and therefore the nirvana that we realize, in a way, is said to be uncreated. We don't create it, either for ourselves or for the world or anything, by achieving it or realizing it. We just ourselves come to recognize it, and in the process of recognizing it, we realize that we were always there already, but we're just distracted by our ignorance and failing to notice that it was always there. So, but the cause of our realization, which is a cause thing, is the Eightfold Path, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Fourth Noble Truth, which has eight components, all eight of which are necessary to realize that nirvana. And of these eight branches of this Eightfold Path, the seventh one is called mindfulness in English. In Sanskrit, it's called smriti. In Pali, it's called sati. Smriti means actually memory, to remember, remembering. So ironically, even though we call it mindfulness, and we say it's when you don't get caught up in memories, it is remembering itself. And actually what it is remembering to be present to what is happening now, rather than remembering something yesterday or the day before, or being sad or happy about something that was bad or good or whatever, which is when memory scatters us away from present awareness. And furthermore, the other way we scatter from present awareness is we anticipate the future. It's sort of like remembering to some imagination of the future. And so that also we try to diminish doing and remembering that we are in a present that is unfolding itself moment by moment. We could say remembering that we're in the present, but in a way, if you think more deeply and carefully, you can't really be in the present either, since the present is sort of like a moving instant between past and future, and you never can quite catch that instant, like a physical line in space. A line has no width, So you're never on a line, actually. A line, to be precise, a line has to be a set of coordinates, a mapping of a position or a concept of a position. But as soon as a line has any width, it's just a long rectangle. Right? So as soon as a moment has any duration, it has a beginning, middle, and end. And even the middle has a beginning, middle, and end. And it also subdivides down to split second, and then split second disappears as having any duration, just like a line disappears as having any width. So you can't actually even be in the present, but therefore you take all of your remembering and you remember what you are in process of doing and being and so on. Right? So that's the seventh branch. Now, many people might say that it is the first branch to when you want to practice heightening your awareness. But the Buddhist tradition and the traditional teaching would not agree with that. Because we do think all the time about a lot of things. And so the first six branches involve a kind of thinking, which is good thinking as opposed to bad thinking. And the first of them, he said, the critical insight of developing what's called a realistic worldview. And a realistic worldview is a very, very important first step, involving our being critical of worldviews, you know, metaphysical theories or scientific theories that tell us things that don't really have evidence, such as that, you know, when we die, we're going to go somewhere else, thanks to God or angels or whatever, some absolutely different place. That's not true. Such as that we don't have a mind or a soul or a consciousness, really, it's just an illusion, and we're only a material configuration of brain matter and flesh and blood and so on. And the idea that our mind is actually a non-existent, a nothing, has no evidence, so that also is a dogmatic view. So a realistic worldview is only, has in a way two sides. One is that all relational things are purely causal. So it's only realistic to expect any kind of relative thing or relative experience to be caused by something, and itself be the cause of something. That's the realistic worldview. Then based on that, on that acceptance of causality, one adopts a realistic purpose of life or motivation for life. Because when you decide what is realistic, you then decide that you're embedded in causation as a relational being, and your purpose then becomes to improve the causes that produce states of being in you, until finally you have no more cause of suffering and you only have causes of happiness or freedom from suffering. So those are the first two steps. Then when you have that realistic purpose or motivation, you have three ethical steps, where you think in terms of being realistic about what you say, realistic speech. You think about being realistic about how you act, not only with your speech and your body, but even with your mind. You know, thinking thoughts are kind of actions. So you decide to have realistic causal or evolutionary action. And those are both connected to ethics as well as to realism. And then the third one is more socially ethical, which is realistic livelihood, meaning you don't want to have any livelihood that is unethical, that is harmful to anybody, and therefore brings harm back on yourself as its evolutionary effect. So those three follow up to five. And then you have realistic creative effort, which is sort of behind the realistic view and the purpose and the speech and the action and the livelihood. because you have to make an effort in the positive and to diminish and be critical of the negative. So realistic effort. And then finally, number seven, then you turn to, you sort of straighten yourself out with those six steps as far as being a spiritual practitioner. And then finally, in the seventh step, you use your memory to become present of what you are doing now, taking all of those things into consideration. Am I being realistic in my worldview, in my motivation, in my speech, in my action, in my livelihood, and in my creativity? Or am I being unrealistic? And that's sort of, you begin to mobilize the mind to examine and to deepen and to also look deeper into how your mind is working to find more vestiges of unrealistic attitudes and actions and behaviors and laziness, which is unrealistic, or lack of effort. Mindfulness does that. And then this eighth step that mindfulness then leads to is where you come to see the deeper. Through mindfulness, you range into the deeper levels of your mind. And then the last step is samadhi, which means concentration in one point. And that's where you sort of drill down deeper into your own reality and you discover your real nature. And ultimately that real nature is freedom from suffering. It's the bliss of emptiness, the clear light of emptiness. And when you find that, then you feel bliss everywhere because you realize it is everywhere. But that's jumping a little bit ahead to some of the other podcasts and teachings. So that's sort of how mindfulness is located. And the beginning place that we do when we start mindfulness, which is not the whole of it, but is the good starting point, is where you count your breath and focus on it. Or you could actually think of a mantra, you know, just repeat a word internally or murmur it even softly with your voice. So you don't have to only count your breath, but that's considered to be very easy and very important. And in a way, we're normally unconscious of our breath. We breathe without paying attention to it. And so it's sort of a bit of realism to observe that we breathe. So it's a good place to start. But the main point of that one is to then notice how your mind is filled with jumbles of distracting thoughts that run here and there, memories, anticipations, you know, criticisms, expressions of dissatisfaction or expressions of glee and joy, but all kinds of commentaries, let's say, on what is happening and where we actually are. And so we're looking at those and learning to dismount from them by disidentifying from being automatically pushed by this or that thought, like, I must do this, I must do that, I must feel this way, I must feel that way. You begin to gain a little freedom and begin to observe the reactive and active and proactive mechanisms in your mind where your mental energy normally gets scattered. And then by learning to dismount from that scattering, you gain a better control over the way your mind works. And then you come to the deeper levels of mindfulness where you can kind of edit so as to weaken negative habitual thoughts and reinforce and strengthen positive thoughts, you know, and make them, which are maybe not so habitual, but you want to make them habitual. So mindfulness goes deeper like that before you shift from it into the deeper samadhi, which is, it's a Sanskrit word, but it's so well known in English now, it's almost gotten into the English dictionary, meaning drilling down very, very stable concentration. Okay, now let's go back and let's meditate again within this context. Okay? Don't even worry about or think about what I just said. Hopefully you can replay the podcast. But forget about it for a moment. Notice that you're breathing. One, two, three, four, 6. Eight. Nine. One. Two. Three. Four. Five. One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, ding.
Greetings and salutations, podcast wallas. This is podcast producer Justin Stone Diaz, and I'd like to welcome you to this podcast extra from the Robert Thurman Archives. As we heard, the first half of this week's podcast extra, Bob led a basic meditation on mindfulness. This version of the meditations is one of my favorites that I've listened to in a while, because it doesn't require any sort of background or formal sitting situation. Bob's really good about making sure to craft the instructions for a general audience, and also for those who do already have an established meditation practice. So unless you sit in a chair or sit on a meditation cushion, I hope you enjoyed that first part of the podcast. Second half of this week's episode is what's known as developing the mind of the Bodhisattva, or developing the spirit of enlightenment meditation. It's from the Lojong tradition, and there'll be notes in the podcast extra about where to find more information and more videos and teachings on this subject. Like the first half of this week's episode podcast extra, it's intended for a general audience and is taken from the Wisdom Academy online course. This online course, which is now ongoing, is called Sutra and Tantra, the Profound and the Miraculous, and it focuses on the teachings and practices of Jaya Tsongkhapa. This week's episode refers to that more. Hope you enjoyed that episode as well. This Wisdom Academy online course is great for people looking to expand their knowledge of Buddhism and specifically Tibetan Buddhism. If you start to dip into Vajrayana or some of the more advanced Tibetan Buddhism practices, you might enjoy this online course. To learn more and to register, visit Wisdom Publications online or look in the podcast description for the link that'll bring you to the course preview. Special thanks to Wisdom Publications for lending us these archives to share with you, our podcast audience. If the meditation, developing the mind of the Bodhisattva, inspires you to deepen your practice and add it to your regular repertoire, be sure to check out Bob Thurman's two books, The Jewel Tree of Tibet and Essential Tibetan Buddhism. Both books have further information on the practices that inspire the meditation in the second half. Again, special thanks to Wisdom Publications for helping us co-create this episode of the Bob Thurman Podcast. The Bob Thurman Podcast is brought to you in part by the generous support of the Tibet House U.S. membership community and listeners like you. To learn more about the benefits of Tibet House membership, including Dasit tours with Robert Thurman and friends, geographic expeditions, please visit tibethouse.us. Tours in 2019 include Sri Lanka. If you're looking for a way to study with Robert Thurman up close and personal, a little closer to home, be sure to visit his programs this summer happening at Menla Retreat and Dewa Spa in Phoenicia, New York. All of August, he has programs on the Kali Chakra, on yoga, on Buddhism, and psychotherapy, among other topics. To learn more, visit menla.us. To watch free previews from the Tibet House U.S. member archives, please visit the Tibet House U.S. and Menla YouTube channel. Free previews of member-only videos are available there. And as always, interstitial music provided by Tenzin Chogyal. All rights reserved, used with the artist's permission. To learn more, visit TenzinChogyal.com.
Podcast 2, Developing the Mind of the Bodhisattva, the Spirit of Enlightenment. The attitude that you yourself will try to be a savior for all beings. Similar perhaps to Thomas A. Kempis, the English mystic's idea of imitatio Christi, the very powerful mystical Christian teaching where instead of letting Jesus save you, you decide to be like Jesus, a savior of all beings. But I will, of course, let Andrew make any comments on that further. But this is what this developing the spirit of enlightenment is. All right, so go into meditative pose. Get settled. You can also sit in a chair if you find sitting cross-legged uncomfortable, of course. The sitting is not the most important part by any means of the meditation. So you can go into a seated posture. But when you do that, just cross your ankles and then try not to lean back in a chair, but sit upright. And with the other, you know, hands in the lap and so forth, lips closed, breathing through nostrils, chin tucked, and eyes half closed, if possible. Okay? So, ding, we enter the meditation, and now we will follow the guided meditation that I will lead. Think about the ageless age of the universe, about how the idea of a first cause or an uncaused cause is irrational and illogical and has no evidence at all. Even when monotheists say that God caused or created the universe, God pre-existed infinitely, of course, so they also perceive a beginningless universe. And many of the scientists, materialists, who think that the mind does not exist or insist that there's no mind outside of the coarse elements that they see as matter, even they say that no matter is ever destroyed, and therefore similarly no matter can ever be created out of nothing. So even they have a beginningless, even though to them it's a material universe. They have a beginningless universe. So whether or not you believe in that you've had a former life or a future life, never mind, ignore that. But try on to imagine that you have had former lives, just to try out as an experiment. And in which case those former lives are beginningless. So that means you've always been alive in some form or another. And that means that you have been in every form, actually. You've been every kind of animal that exists, including, from the Buddhist point of view, angel, deity, and 26 different kinds of deities, and also demons. And you've been in hells, and you've been in some what's called Preta realm, which people wrongly call a hungry ghost, but it's a very, very sad and hungry and thirsty being, sort of be in the direction of insects, but far beyond the strangeness of being an insect. And then regular animals other than the human animal. So you've been every single kind of being, because you can't say that you haven't in a beginningless lifespan that you have had. So you've been everywhere, done everything, experienced everything. And if trying that out, just meditate on that, what it might be like. And so in a sense, your instincts that you now have, which you think of as sort of built into you, automatic, they have been shaped and formed by an infinite number of previous lives. And you have had the great fortune now to be a being, a human being, who is not completely only driven by habit, although still strongly driven by habit. But you're a human being that can make free choices. You don't need a philosopher to tell you that either ultimately you have free will or ultimately you don't have free will. You don't really need that yet, because you know very well that you can make choice A and choice B, and these bring you very different outcomes. And you having learned those from experience, and then you freely choose A or B in many situations. You know that. Practically, you live like that. You may not know that sort of cosmically, but practically, you do live like that. So you have some sort of functional freedom of will. It doesn't matter right now whether it's an ultimate thing or a not ultimate thing. Point is, your choices make a difference. And you luckily got to be this type of being that can think very clearly and critically about their choices. To go left or right, up or down, be good or bad, be generous or stingy, be happy or sad. There's lots of choices. Many times we're driven and we feel we can't choose, can't restrain. But still, we do have these choices. Then the second thing you think about that startles you, once you have accepted experimentally, I'm not saying you have to believe in that. It's not easy for people to do that if they really have stuck in some ideology or another. But if you thought about the irrationality of something from nothing, then you might realize that maybe there is such an expansion backward in time toward beginninglessness. So the chicken and egg issue, but non-vicious infinite regress. So then second, you meditate that every other living being has also had a beginningless lives. The third shocking implication of that is, logically speaking, you have had relationships with every other being, given you all have an infinite past, eternal past, beginningless past. So you've been and done everything in relation to everybody. And most importantly, for this meditation, you don't emphasize the negative interactions you had, and instead you focus on the positive interactions you've had. And in theory, the most positive interaction you can have with another biological being is to be the child of a mammalian mother, and especially human mother. Because even without that mother having some special spirituality, although all humans have spirituality, but still without anything special, that mother bore you in her womb for 9 months, gave birth to you with great labor, pains, and difficulty, then nursed you or fed you, cleaned you, protected you, put your needs above her needs for years, cuddled you, loved you, cherished you, did all kind of fantastic, selfless, altruistic things for you without a special theory of altruism, just naturally did it. So, and if you think about what that means, it means that that being, that mother being, like your mother of this life, if you're a human being now listening to this, she shared her bloodstream with you first thing she did. And second thing is she shared her milk stream with you, which sort of calcium from her bones, you know, lymph from her system, whatever milk is made of. You know, she digested food, she drank whatever milk, she drank whatever she needed to replenish her supply, and then she fed you, and or mothers, when they didn't have a supply, they would still feed the child. So this is called, this meditation is called the recognition of the mother, and the recognition of that all beings have been your mother, and or you could call it the recognition of motherliness in all beings, and specifically motherliness to you, motherliness to me. So this is very deep, and when you realize that one byproduct of this particular step of an 11-fold set of steps we're gonna dance through in this meditation together. A byproduct of it is when you walk in a crowded street with people walking in the opposite direction, you have a funny feeling of sort of deja vu when you see people, because you've been kind of infusing a motherly look, the gaga loving look of the mother. You've been infusing that in many, many faces around you, thinking of all beings, you know. And when you do that, you should reflect on specific ones that you know, ones your friends, who now are your friend. Maybe they are males even in this life, but they were your mother. Your enemies, maybe your enemy now in this life, may not be female even in this life, but they were your mother. Some aggressive animal that attacks you, of course, couldn't possibly be your mother in this life, but they were your mother in a past life. Some person that you don't know yet, just a stranger, also was your mother. So as you do this, you get down in your mind and your memory to the motherly feeling, the way when you, because you, we all have a subconscious imprint of our actual mother's loving look from the first moments when we were born, which we don't normally consciously remember. But if you practice this meditation for a while, you will actually be able to remember that, because it is in your memory. So all beings, I recognize you, all beings, as my mothers, my motherly beings. Second step then, once this gets a little solidified, and as I say, when everyone starts to look more familiar to you, you know, family are to you, that means you've made some progress in this meditation. You see beings as less strange and more familiar. Very powerful, actually. Second step is you think about the kindness of your mother of this life. And you try to remember when you were held by your mother, and you were gurgled by your mother, and you were nursed by your mother, and you were held warmly and caressed by your mother, and she sang you sweet lullabies, and she cuddled you and chucked your chin in an appreciative manner and looked out of these absolutely adoring eyes at you. And with also great concern, in case you had a little colic or you had a little stomach upset or needed to be burped or you were hungry or whatever it was, she completely was attuned to you. And you think of what a tremendous effort that was for many years even, day and night, that your mother was this occupied with you and preoccupied with you. And then the success of this step of the meditation is you will feel tears. It's a sentimental meditation. It's meant to be sentimental. And you will actually feel tears of gratitude when you really can remember. Even if you had later personality struggles with your mother here and there of this life, she still had tremendous concern for you when you were too small to remember now, normally. But you can remember now. And as you feel that sentimentality, and as you feel tears, and as you feel like kind of like amazement, and hackles rise on the back of little hairs on the back of your neck, and so on, you feel like chills of sentimentality. Even as you do that, you then diffuse that feeling and that sense of gratitude to all the motherly beings. And you realize that you kind of owe all of them gratitude for all their tremendous kindness, because they all did this for you, lifetime after lifetime, many of them maybe infinite lifetimes. It's an overwhelming feeling of gratitude to all of them, diffused from your specific focusing on the gratitude you feel to your elderly mother of this life. Then that brings you naturally into the third step, where you come to another aspect of gratitude, which is you really would like to repay that kindness. You would like to, if possible, mother all the beings yourself and be as altruistic and giving to them as they to you have been to you, just like we normally do when someone does great things for us. At some point, our gratitude wells up and we want to do great things for them. So that's the third step, is repaying the kindness step. But this is just meditation, so we imagine repaying the kindness. We cultivate the will to do so, to make those mothers happy like she made us happy, like all of those she's made us happy. And then that brings you to the fourth step, where you call the step of lovely love, where you think about your mothers being happy, all beings being happy. And you visualize beings who may not at all normally be much happy, but you visualize them in happiness. Because in a way, when you want them to be happy, you can develop a kind of concentrated fantasy of them being happy. And what would they look like if they were really grooving, if they were really flipped out, if they really felt ecstatic and really relieved and really happy? And you realize they would be beautiful. Because when beings feel a strong inner happiness, the smile breaks out spontaneously. They have a glow in their eyes. They are beautiful. You see the beauty in a happy person because it shines forth from them. And in a way, it really is the secret of a beautiful person, is an inner happiness, an inner contentment, and a kind of inherited, you know, the psychologists call it, from having been well brought up as infants, a kind of positive set point of contentment and happiness. But from Buddha's point of view, it is the essence of the human being, actually, and it comes even from previous lives as well. It can be spoiled by very, very harsh and traumatic upbringing, of course, as a human. So that's the lovely love step. Then the fifth step, you then decide, okay, because you get a kind of target out of the lovely love step. You see the beings as happy. So then you decide, well, where are they right now? I mean, where do I start from in making them as happy and beautiful as that? And then you start thinking or imagining, of course, in meditating, the beings around you and the beings around the world. And immediately you're kind of overwhelmed by the huge, vast mass of suffering of all the beings. And then this is the step of total compassion for all beings. You don't want your mothers to suffer. You have sort of seen them as motherly to you, and you have felt tremendous gratitude for their kindness, and you want to repay that kindness. And then you've seen them as possibly happy and lovely when in that being happy, and then you really want them to do so. And then you see how far short of that happiness they are. So then you cultivate compassion where the actual suffering that they may seem to be having when you tour around among the beings in your mind seems unbearable to you. It's just as intolerable as your own pain is their pain. And this makes you actually a bit agitated. You feel uneasy, you know. You know, you might get tired of it or something. You might tell yourself, well, I couldn't sustain this, but actually you can. Especially in this context, you can. But you get a little bit agitated, and then you lean into that agitation in the sixth step. And then, although here now you might introduce a different thing, where you might notice that these suffering beings are just like you, in that one way they are suffering just from some pain or some shortcoming or some poverty or some injury or some violence or some chaos. They are suffering. You can see that. And you remember when you have suffered from injury or violence or loss or whatever it is, chaos, anxiety. And when you did, you felt, this is really wrong. I don't deserve to suffer like this. I shouldn't be suffering like this. I should be relieved of this suffering. I should be happy. And you kind of double suffer because you are suffering, whatever the pain and the problem and the shortfall is. And you're also suffering because you're suffering. You're very, very distressed that you should be. And you feel you have a right not to suffer. And it's wrong that you're suffering. And then you realize, in this context, when you think that they all do too. And they all feel they shouldn't suffer and they should have a right to be happy. They all feel that, just like you do. And you realize when you feel so frustrated, when you feel that way, you suddenly realize how frustrated they are in their wish to be happy. And then you see a vast, huge mass of that frustration. And you realize that just as you are very concerned to remove your own frustration and be happy instead of suffering, you should expand that concern and you should not differentiate between your suffering and their suffering. And you should really want to free them from suffering. And this is called the exchange of self and other, or the exchange of self-preoccupation for other preoccupation. By recognizing all the other beings' self-preoccupation, you join them in being preoccupied for them as more of a priority for you than being preoccupied for yourself, which is your own habit, perhaps. Too much our own habit. And so we become more preoccupied for them. And we switch the thing. We look at ourselves from the eyes of the other. And therefore, we naturally become invested in seeing them free from suffering, just like without thinking, almost like a natural reflex, just like when I put my hand on a hot pot on the stove by accident, I just pulled it off really quickly from the heat, from the burning, without thinking, should I do this, should I not do this, is there something else I should do? No such question, I just pull it off. So then you come, this is the sixth step where you intensify the agitation actually and say, well, really, I should do this for them myself. I've got to focus on what I can do for all these mother beings. If necessary, I'll be their mother all over again myself, infinite, in the infinite future. Never mind. They are suffering so huge, how can I bother waste my time on my little frustration? So you come in a line like that, and then you should be, you're being successful in the meditation if you feel very, very highly agitated at this time, like someone who wants to be a messiah figure, wants to be a savior of beings, and how can I do it, what can I do, type of thing. And then the seventh step where you produce, you create, you conceive the spirit of enlightenment. you rise to the Bodhisattva attitude, the messianic attitude, and you think, actually, if I'm going to, beyond feeling agitated and beyond really wishing to do for everything, for everyone, myself, I must admit to myself that I cannot do that in my present condition. I cannot even really ward off completely my own suffering, much less all the other beings. And therefore I must become perfectly enlightened Buddha, who is said to be a being that is perfected in wisdom, knows the reality of self and other completely, and perfected in compassion, and manifests or emanates or lives only to benefit others because of having found such a huge self-satisfaction in nirvana and the nature of reality, finds it unbearable that others have not found that same satisfaction in nirvana, and thereby devotes their entire existence to helping them find nirvana. So then you meditate, I will become such a Buddha for the sake of all the suffering beings, all my mother's suffering beings. I will relieve them from this suffering by helping them discover their own true reality, by giving them the Buddha's teaching that teaches their own true reality. I will do that. Ding. That's the end of this loving kindness, spirit of enlightenment meditation. If you are a Buddhist, at that point, at the end of that, when you actually do it fully, which might take a few months, some people it might take years. Some people it can quickly happen, maybe in a few weeks. So all people are very different. And when you reach that, then you would take the Bodhisattva vow, which would be all my future lives, in all this life, all my future lives, I will bend every effort to be a Bodhisattva and to do the Bodhisattva deeds of generosity, morality, patience, creativity, concentration and wisdom and skill in liberative art and prayer and power and intuitive knowledge. I will do that in all my future lives until I become a perfect Buddha and I can benefit all beings. One makes a vow like that. But you should not jump to make that vow until... these people in Buddhist societies do that, but I always say to people in our Western society, where even though we may be nominally religious in some way, including possibly nominally Buddhist or any of the other religions, but yet our reality view is shaped by materialist science. So we really don't viscerally feel in a common sense way that we will have all these future lives. We sort of think the whole thing is just whatever happens to me in this life. Then it makes no sense to make such a vow. And one can only experimentally use in a meditation to see how it feels, the idea of an infinite past series of lives, beginningless series of lives, and an endless series of future lives. Although if we come to feel that as a common sense reality, it will transform the way we live for sure. 100%. Huge shift. Cosmic shift. So that's the sevenfold, maybe eightfold step, you could say, with some fringe benefits. Oh, and one last thing, it's just before quitting. The Dalai Lama always says, by the way, that if you really decide to be preoccupied with others' condition and to focus on helping them relieve their suffering, and you switch out of your constant concern for your own well-being, your own freedom from suffering, Not that you want to harm yourself either, but you just don't make it your priority concern. If you do that, he jokingly says, but meaning it, the first person who you make happy with that new resolve is you yourself. Because actually one of the secrets to happiness is not focusing on how happy you are. So because we know that from experience, as soon as we evaluate and focus on how happy am I, we're immediately dissatisfied because we think, well, I'm just not happy enough. It could be more this way and that way. I could have this thing and that thing. You know, then we become discontented and then frustrated and then we don't appreciate what we have. We all know that. So at least in focusing on others' condition like that, what happens is you at least forget about yours temporarily. So you kind of lower your priority of your self-concern and make your top priority other concern, altruism. And that cheers you up a lot, actually, automatically. If you know truly altruistic people, which would not necessarily include sort of martyrish people who kind of make a big fuss how altruistic they are, but actually act bitter and kind of resentful about it and tell you, well, I did this for them and I did the other for the other, and it was a problem for them. So that's not the true altruist. Will inevitably be quite cheerful. They'll be sort of, let's have a cup of tea in the middle of the crisis, or let's do something. They'll find something, some angle about it because they have to, like a good mother who loves that child who's having a tantrum, and then she distracts it by there's your little doggy, or there's your toy, or, oh, what did so-and-so say? You know, like, oh, look at that, you know, like, instead of trying to head on, sort of suppress the temper. And she has the skill of doing that, you know. And she has a good cheer is her primary thing, not getting drawn into the tantrum. Okay? Okay, all the best. That's the second podcast, the podcast of developing the loving mind, the loving enlightened mind, enlightened loving mind. Okay? Ding.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Bob Thurman Podcast. I'm deeply grateful for all the shares, likes, comments, and subscriptions we get. And if you'd like to reach me personally, I can be found on most social media platforms as Justin Stoned. If you have specific suggestions, comments, or just want to share an idea with me, please email me directly via my personal email, which is justin@menla.org. I look forward to hearing from you. Tashi Dalek, and thanks for tuning in.